Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the intensifying war in Syria, where the embattled Assad regime resorted to the use of fixed-wing aircraft today in what is seen as a serious escalation. Joshua Landis, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, who writes the daily newsletter on Syrian politics, Syria Comment, joins us to discuss the endgame in Syria and the possible use of WMDs. Then we'll speak with the executive director of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, David Clossy, about the sentencing today of the first high-level official in the Catholic Church to go to jail for covering up the abuse of children by Catholic priests. We'll discuss the long cover-up and the billions spent to hide what seems to be a systemic problem within the male-dominated Catholic clergy. Then finally, we'll look into the pain in Spain as speculators pile on, forcing up the borrowing costs of Spanish debt to unsustainable levels. Anthony Geist, professor of Spanish and comparative literature at the University of Washington, Seattle, joins us. He is just back from Spain, and we will discuss how the average Spaniard is coping with austerity and soaring unemployment that again exposes the weakness of the political leadership of the Eurozone that appears consistently unable to get on top of a growing economic crisis. Joining us now is Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And clearly the civil war, which the Red Cross have now designated, that there is a civil war going on in Syria, it's intensified today with the bombing of Aleppo by Syrian Air Force fighter planes. That's considered a significant escalation in the conflict. And then you also have the recent statements by a Syrian government official acknowledging the existence of weapons of mass destruction, saying they won't be used against the Syrian people, but they would be used against foreign invaders. This is starting to get ugly, surely.
It is getting ugly. And we've seen forays by the opposition into the heart of Damascus. They were pushed out, but leaving quite a bit of devastation behind. The regime has tried not to use airplanes, but we've seen them steadily ratchet up the amount of force that they're using. First going to tanks, then using heavy artillery in the cities, and now helicopters, and now air attack planes. So the situation is deteriorating badly for the government, and we've also seen over the last several weeks a series of high-level Sunni defections from the regime. So that the basic alliance undergirding the regime between Sunnis and Alawites has now in falling apart. It hasn't completely come apart, but it's falling apart quickly, and we've got new defections today of ambassador for Cyprus. But the explosion in downtown Damascus that killed a number of the very, top security people in the regime. So things are going very badly for the government, and it's unclear how this is going to play out because there are over 100 militias active in Syria as part of this Free Syrian Army.
Well, the Iranians, of course, have taken a role in this from the beginning. There are varying reports suggesting that in many ways, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps are micromanaging a lot of the response from the Free Syrian Army. The commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guards said that decisive blows would be struck against Syria's enemies, particularly the hated Arabs, if they intervene in this conflict. So you have Iran putting its red line down. You have Russia now apparently urging Assad to adhere to his international obligations regarding their chemical arsenal. I would assume that the United States has told the Assad regime if they use chemical weapons against their own people, that's the red line at which the U.S. and NATO would get involved. So walk us through these red lines as much as you understand them, Joshua Landis.
Well, both the Israelis and the U.S. have been talking about what to do about the chemical weapons. And Jihad Mekdis, he's the spokesperson for the Foreign Office in Syria, his statement yesterday coming out and saying we will not use them against, you know, in this internal struggle, but if anybody attacks us, we will, is, again, trying to make clear, I think, trying to push off any possible invasion or incursion from the U.S. and Israel to destroy the chemical weapons, but at the same time letting other neighbors like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, know that they shouldn't intervene more. And this is Iran's statement. It's the same thing. Iran, when they talk about the Arabs, mean the Gulf Arabs and Saudi Arabia, which is the major financial backer for the opposition and the rebels in Syria. So Iran is backing the Syrian regime with money and arms. Saudi Arabia is backing the rebels with money and arms. And, of course, the international community, United States and Europe, is backing the rebels with non-lethal aid. But presumably the Saudis and the Qataris and the Gulfies have got enough money. It's the intelligence that that America can play an important role with. And Russia, of course, Iran and China, too, are defending Syria, perhaps less with weapons today, although they have been the main suppliers of weapons, but in the UN, as we saw, by vetoing and giving moral support.
Well, I don't imagine, though, Joshua Landis, that Israel would ever intervene, would it, unless there was evidence that Assad was transporting the chemical arsenal to Hezbollah.
Right. You know, unless they feel that the chemical weapons are going to get out of government control and that the government will lose control and that they could go to al-Qaeda-type elements, any kind of a... The problem for Israel, of course, is that they don't want anybody to get those weapons because once they go to militias, they can be traded, they can be sold, they lose control. If the Syrian government has them, you can threaten the Syrian government, and it is accountable. It's got an address, but these militias don't necessarily have return address, and you don't know where they can go to. It could go to Hezbollah, could go to Hamas, could go to many different groups that would later become troublesome for Israel.
So, again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. We're talking about the deteriorating situation in Syria, where there's a likelihood of the use of chemical weapons. There's already been the employment of fixed-wing aircraft, which has been considered a red line that the Assad regime have crossed. And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that the rebels will eventually form safe havens inside Syria. Now, that could be interpreted as being pretty loaded, couldn't it, Joshua, that what the Secretary of State's saying is that if the Free Syrian Army creates safe havens, then that means that essentially those areas would be protected by outside forces? Is that...
You know, that is a line that I don't think the U.S. has really determined yet. Obviously...
Well, how would they be safe? I mean, who would guarantee their safety? That is
the big question. The United States has bent over backwards not to get involved militarily in this conflict, creating a no-fly zone over Syria, shooting down the Syrian Air Force, of course, puts the United States in deeply involved in this because they'll have to take out any anti-aircraft missiles before they go in and shoot down the airplanes. Now, I suppose they could do this in a number of different ways, but once you begin to do that, you increasingly take responsibility for the troubles in Syria, and you do it, knock out the planes, presumably to bring down the death rate. It would be for humanitarian reasons. And then when you destroy the regime, let's say you do, and the death rate goes up, should it go up if there were civil war, as it did in Iraq, then do you have to intervene in order to bring it down and become adjudicator in a civil war? That's what I think Hillary Clinton is trying not to do, and that's why they've said that they will not intervene in Syria before the elections, and that's why the NATO has said they will not intervene in Syria, saying that this is not Libya. So I think the West may not be saying that they're going to intervene militarily. They may be saying that the opposition is going to win one way or the other. And that already much of Syrian territory has fallen out of government control into opposition control. Now, the opposition can't guarantee that it can hold it forever, because especially as the government begins to use these fixed-wing airplanes, they're wreaking havoc. But as we're seeing, the opposition is moving into the two main cities. Both Aleppo and Damascus have seen opposition fighting, and that was the red line before for the regime. Had been able to keep the rebels out of downtown, the big cities, for fear of a Tahrir Square moment, that it would just be overwhelmed, and government offices would be overwhelmed if the people in the big cities came out. And that's what the Syrian opposition today is focused on, is getting into the downtown Damascus particularly, because once they do that, it becomes very difficult for the Syrian regime to take it back. And in taking it back, they have to destroy the downtown capital city, which turns everybody against them.
Well, I think probably it's fair to say, Joshua Landis, that the majority of the Syrian people are against this regime, and they probably have been for decades. They just haven't had the ability to do anything about it because of the pervasive repression of this regime that put on a very friendly outward face. But inside, there was a serious red line that, you know, as long as you maintain the fiction that we, the Assads, are destined to be your leaders and accept it, everything's fine. The minute you step out of line, you get crushed or tortured or disappeared. I mean, that's been the compact, and that's broken down. But it's the fear factor that's still there, because they seem to be prepared to destroy these cities rather than allow the people to coalesce in that Tahrir Square moment that you mentioned.
Well, that's becoming increasingly clear, and that's what they're doing. And I think many people thought that when it came to downtown Damascus, Assad would shrink from destroying downtown Damascus. But Homs, a city, the third largest city in Syria, has been destroyed. Hama, of course, was destroyed by his father, the fourth largest city. But Damascus, clearly, the regime resides in Damascus. All the government offices are in Damascus. When this regime loses Damascus, it will become essentially an Alawite militia on the ground, and it will no longer have any claims to being a Syrian army.
And do you think that that's inevitable? It seems.
I do think it's inevitable. I think that's where the opposition is headed. That most of the Western world and the Gulf are committed to that outcome, and they have said that they will. You know, Saudi Arabia and Qatar are reputedly have increased the inflow of arms tremendously in the last few weeks, and I think we'll continue to ratchet up that effort, because I think they see the regime hanging by a thread. They want to finish this and tip the balance in the favor of the opposition.
Again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. So this would probably end then without any intervention by Western powers. I know that the French and the Saudis at one point weighed in on the White House. Sarkozy wanted to use the aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle, along with the Saudi Defense Minister Salman, to use their air force and cross over Jordan in a coordinated French-Saudi attack on Mount Qasum, I think it's called, the palace.
Palace.
Just on the outskirts of Damascus. And that was vetoed by the White House, who were expected to provide electronic cover to jam the Russian anti-aircraft missile. So there are some people out there itching to pull the trigger.
Well, of course, Sarkozy is no longer.
And I think
France. So.
Yeah, exactly. I think Obama figured that the guy was trying to rescue his presidency.
I do, and I don't think that Obama wanted to get sucked in, because that's the way they, in a sense, they went into Libya, and it turned into a much longer battle. And I think everyone believes that Syria will be much more complicated, and the downside will be the potential for a civil war. And that's because the opposition is so fragmented in Syria. That, I think, is the real cautionary, you know, that's the real problem for this administration, is that they don't want to get into another nation-building project in a big Arab country. America's proven that they're not very good at that, and I think that's why Obama's got his heels dug in and is trying not to be sort of pushed into taking on Syria.
Well, we'll wait and see what happens in the next couple of days when his challenger Romney meets with his close friend, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. I thank you for joining us, Joshua Landis.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the sentencing today of a Catholic Monsignor, the first ever to go to jail for covering up child abuse.
It's all about strikes now, so it would strike in.